You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's guest is science fiction legend Larry Niven. I was lucky enough to get to be on a panel with him at last week's Dragon Con in Atlanta, where I was able to do a sort of conversation slash interview with him in front of a live ballroom audience of his fans. Many thanks to Sue Phillips of the Sci-Fi Literature Track for asking me to do this. It was an honor and a privilege. All parties involved were fine with me recording it for presentation here, so you could enjoy it as well. So without further ado, here is my conversation with the great Larry Niven.
All right, can you hear me? Yeah, sounds good. DragonCon 2013 in the house! And you know who else is in the house? Larry Niven. Honored to have you here, Larry. My name is Van Allen Plexico. I'm not going to say much about me, but just real quick who I am. I'm a science fiction and pulp writer, part of the SF Lit track, and I am honored to be able to moderate today. I'm going to do some questions myself, and then we'll see what you guys have to ask. Larry is a world-renowned science fiction writer, all kind of awards, invented among many things, the Ring World. Everybody loves the Ring World. And we're just glad to have you.
I'm delighted to be here. You guys treat your guests very well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, let's get on right on into it then. We've got about an hour to chat here. Like I said, I have a few questions for you, and then we'll see what the folks out there have to ask. I'm sure they probably have even better questions than me. What I really wanted to start with, because I've been reading your stuff since Ringworld Engineers came out. I showed you that the first book of yours I ever got was Ringworld Engineers, and I had to go back and get Ringworld. I know what they were talking about a lot of the time, but I loved it anyway. And I remember immediately wanting to know about you, and like, how did you get started and everything, because I thought, wow, this guy's such a cool writer. And I remember reading a little bit about how you got into science fiction writing in the first place, something to do with you were in college, you were like a math studies person, and then you found some magazines or something. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I found a used bookstore jammed with old magazines, science fiction magazines and books. And I came home with a stack that tall. They were going for like a quarter each. Irresistible to a cheap bastard like myself. I flunked out of Caltech after a year and talked my way back in and flunked out after another quarter. Finished at Washburn University, which eventually gave me a D-Lit, honorary doctorate in literature.
Well, so, when you started out doing math, did you think you'd end up with a doctorate in literature?
I did not. I went for the math degree because I was told I'd done the 99.9 percentile on the college aptitude tests. I thought that nailed me. I've always been looking for my niche until I found out I could write fiction.
So once you started reading these magazines and everything, I'm assuming it inspired you, got you interested, piqued your imagination and everything. Was that sort of your first encounter with science fiction? Was there anything before that that got you as a younger person?
There were fairy tales, but I was getting too old for them.
Yeah.
So I tried some science fiction. a couple or three came from my uncles, but from the Hawthorne grade school library, I got a really bad science fiction novel that might have stopped me. Probably none of you will remember anything about it, and I've forgotten the title. Mars was occupied by intelligent onions and intelligent carrots, and they were at a war.
Austin Space.
Austin Space. So this book almost cost us Larry Niven as a writer, in other words.
Yes.
Oh.
Then I found Heinlein.
Oh, yeah. All right. So we've got you reading these magazines and possibly failing out of college, but that's okay because you were having a training in the field that really suited you. So how did you transition from reading that stuff and getting inspired to actually beginning to write? First, you wrote The Coldest Place.
There was an ad in the back of a magazine, Famous Writers School. They will teach you to write correspondence course. I signed up for that, and I got two-thirds of the way through, but by then I was selling. So I quit in the middle of characterization. make of it what you will.
Not sure I should go there. Actually, I do. You know what? I'm going to jump ahead then, because that was a question I was going to ask you. One of the first ones I had in mind, actually, is that you really are known. Your reputation, I think, first and foremost, your reputation, is for these big mind-blowing concepts, these sort of realistically based yet humongous, pushing it to the far, envelope, the ring world, the general products hole, these sort of things kind of push technology very far ahead.
Yeah. I've been accused of being a minimalist, too. I don't put things in the... it's a matter of cutting until the storyline is lean. I constantly put in things that don't necessarily belong to the story. They're just there for the scenery. And as for the reaching, yes, that's exactly right. I push it as far as it can go.
Right. Well, yeah, very quickly you took known space to the point where, you had an indestructible hull, and if something could still get through that, you had stasis.
Yeah.
So
that was for the sake of one story. It became a staple of known space, the general products hull, but mostly I wanted something strong enough. I needed a hull strong enough to allow no other answer but the answer I wanted. A lot of people write that way.
Does that go back to Neutron Star? Was it the tidal forces?
Yes, it's Neutron Star.
Right, right.
First appearance of a general products hull, and the answer is nothing can get through except gravity
and tides. Tidal forces, yeah, yeah. So once you had the general products hull introduced in Neutron Star, you kind of knew you had to use it in Ring World, but it gave you a spaceship that could bounce for a long way.
I found it convenient. The reason your general products hull is transparent is because I got tired of the little bitty windows on airplanes. They're much bigger now.
Yeah, I like how you always said the general products hull is transparent, and if somebody wanted a wall, they basically just spray painted it or whatever, right?
Yeah.
You could just paint it.
You don't start with a wall and cut holes in it. You start with a transparent hull and spray paint where you want it. Want it blocked.
Okay, well, I guess kind of where I was going with that then was, so you definitely have these concepts, these big ideas, but I think that your character stuff is and your dialogue are maybe underrated, if only because the other stuff is so flashy and big. So That's what I was going to ask you. Is where do you think? How do you feel about the two, one versus the other? Do you have to put more effort into one or the other? Is one more important than the other to you? How do you?
No, they're two different skills, two different sets of skills, and you're not cutting into one by concentrating on the other. You have to concentrate on both. And I'd love to be admired for my literary skills.
Absolutely. So you've written Known Space. We're talking about that, and there's several anthologies that were out as early as maybe the late 60s that were Known Space, early 70s maybe, because Ringworld was 1970, right?
Yeah, the Known Space collections amounted to, five or six, they ran up into the 80s, I think.
Mm-hmm. And, but you've done other sort of universes that aren't related to Known Space. Like the World at a Time is a separate, and that's a separate milieu entirely from Known Space, right? And
yes, I've worked in several universes. Right.
What is Known Space, the one closest to your heart, or have you kind of moved on from it and you're on more interested in something else now, or what? What are you saying?
Truth is, I've lost some faith in the funny assumptions of Known Space. I prefer working in a slower than light universe. This isn't just a matter of literary techniques. It's harder to write in a slower than light universe because you can't go anywhere you want as fast as you want. On the other hand, you can generate stories from the assumptions. But mainly, in a slower than light universe, it becomes less likely that some alien is going to barge into our universe and change all the rules. After all, if the universe is 13.7 billion years old, and the sun, the solar system, is only 5 billion years old, that's 8 and a fraction billion years in which aliens could have an advance upon us. The oldest aliens in the universe might be, 3 to 4 to 5 billion years old. And that's even allowing for time for lots of supernova to generate lots of matter besides hydrogen and helium so that we can have planets. The alien we're going to find is likely to arrive here before we go there. And we may not like it. I feel safer in a slower than light universe.
We might not like it, especially if they have a general products hull. We can't shoot them down. Isn't that interesting, though, that it seems to me that, like, in the first few decades of sort of modernish science fiction, authors were always trying to find a way to justify and to go faster than light. And then once everybody was going faster than light, then start thinking, wait a minute, here's the problems that come from that. Maybe we should back off again and it'd be more interesting to write slower than light.
That is the way it went. Not just with me, but with lots of writers.
Yeah.
Today's hard science fiction is a lot harder than yesterday's. The Ringworld today would be considered soft science fiction. There are too many funny assumptions. Faster than light travel, three kinds of ultra-strong materials.
Well, I think a lot of very, very modern hard science fiction almost uses the tech stuff like product placement, like, ooh, look what this writer knows about. Look what I know about that I read in Popular Science yesterday or something. Your stuff never came across that way. Your stuff always seemed very organic, like it was just part of the universe and everybody knew about it and it was just already there. It never seemed like, look what I just found out about, you know.
I'm glad it seemed that way because that takes a lot of work. But but on the contrary, I was certainly showing off what I knew, hoping to get into print before somebody else with the newest developments.
Well, and that takes us back to the coldest place, right? Because the original idea was that the coldest place in the solar system, I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, talk about it, was the dark side of Mercury because they thought that it was tidally locked, right?
Yes.
And it was somewhere in there, right around the process of you sending it in, that they found something different?
Shortly after I cashed the check.
Yeah, there you go.
the news broke from Russia, not that Mercury was spinning differently from the way we thought, but that that Mercury had an atmosphere and lost it continually because it's so small, but continually gained it back because of the solar wind. It's all hydrogen. Then they discovered Mercury rotated 1.5 times per year. But by then, you know, I cashed the check, the story got printed. I was off and running. $25.
You didn't want to go in maybe like liquid paper over it and say Pluto, Pluto, Pluto or something, did you?
Never crossed my mind. But you've got the technique down pat.
Well, while we're talking about your technology a little bit, I've always wondered this. If there was one of your pieces of technology that you've come up with and used in these stories that you could actually have in real life, which one would you choose?
Man, I'm 75 years old. I'd choose something medical. I'd choose the Autodox.
The Autodox.
Or as close as I could get. I'd use booster spice, of course, if we were that advanced. How good are you at granting wishes?
Well, I got a flashlight laser is all fine and dancy and dandy and fancy, but yeah, I guess it doesn't have a lot of medicinal properties, does it? So, okay, well, that's cool. A couple of other things before I ask the audience. You're famous for doing a number of different collaborations with different authors, and
yes,
most famously, I guess, Jerry Purnell. Tell us a little bit about. Tell us a little bit about working with Jerry and how that has gone over the years.
Okay. In most cases, my collaborator has tracked me down, stalked me. It was true for Stephen Barnes. He's told me about how he did it. And it was true for Jerry, who braced me at a convention. Not a science fiction convention, actually, but the first BoucherCon, a detective story convention, tracked me down, suggested we collaborate. I'd already done a collaboration with David Gerald and enjoyed it very much. So I said, sounds like fun, let's give it a try. We got together one night, and Jerry had his empire of 1,000 worlds, all of it human. And I had this leftover alien from a novel that hadn't gelled. And I tossed I realized that his faster-than-light drive allowed planets within his empire that had never been touched. He had a sort of a gateway combination worked up for him by Dan Alders, the Caltech's sane genius, they called him. Dan Alderson, and he did a lot of work with us. He worked up the Alderson drive. I looked it over and realized I could have planets set within the empire, and I put one behind the coal sack where it couldn't be discovered. I should say we by now. Jerry and I were exchanging ideas at a furious rate over coffee and brandy. We took my alien, planted it in the right place, worked up a dozen species of varieties of Modis. And at that point, we were off and running, I thought. I thought he was... I took a trip to England with my wife shortly thereafter, and I figured he was working on the book. Maybe he was working on the book. He didn't generate any text, but that is the way Jerry Purnell works. I've gradually found out. He does a lot of study and then plunges in. Me, I suck it out of my fingertips. At any rate, that was a mote in God's eye, and. It took us a long time, longer than we expected, by a lot. Twice running, the Losfus gave Jerry and me the best, their award for best unpublished novel. Because we talked about it so much. And then we sent it to, Jerry sent it to Robert Heinlein because they were old friends. I knew the man, but only by a little. Jerry sent the book to him. Robert went through it and made some suggestions and said, if you'll do it this way, I'll be able to say this is the best science fiction novel I ever read. And we took his suggestions. That sounds so easy, doesn't it? But Robert Heinlein has often made suggestions for a friend to use and never seen all of them used. He was stuck. In his own mind, he was stuck. He looked through the altered manuscript and did an entire proofreading job on it. I can tell you these things now because Robert is dead. He made a swear never to tell anybody that he'd done that while he was still alive. Can you imagine how many friends Robert Heinlein had who would have wanted him to do a full proofreading job on their next book?
Wow.
Ooh.
That's amazing. Yeah.
At any rate, that's what started my work with Jerry Pournelle. We were in the middle of a second novel called Oath of Fealty when it dawned on me that I hiked with him and drank with him. And eventually it became only hiking, but that was much later. It dawned on me that this guy kept talking about religion, God, comparative religion, theological subjects and puzzles. He was the perfect guy to do something I'd been daydreaming about without any real intent. A sequel to Dante's Inferno. Now, mind you, a sequel to Dante's Inferno takes a certain amount of arrogance, even though everybody has played in that man's playground. I put it to Jerry. I made him write it with me. And there we were. I should tell you about Simon & Schuster. They always do something. They're always profitable. But they always do something dreadful. In this case, they tied Inferno to A Mote in God's Eye, which means that the money for the royalties for A Mote in God's Eye go to pay off the advance for Inferno, a thing publishers sometimes do when they've got not much faith in a book. The assumption, however, is that they'll publish the damn thing. They'd used up our royalties to cover the advance before anyone ever got around to doing that. You guys are mostly youths, I think, so you haven't been deprived of a book, but the oldest among you didn't see the book for 2 or 3 years. What else would you like to know about collaborating with Jerry?
Right, well, let's see. So you did A Mote in God's Eye and you did Inferno. And then maybe the one that's, I mean, certainly Mote in God's Eye is very well known.
Lucifer's Hammer is the one that's going to change the piece. Here's how that happened, because it's a pretty interesting writer's story. Robert Gleason had worked on several of our books before working on Mote in God's Eye. He was going to work on Inferno, but he changed jobs. He was at Playboy. Now he was at Playboy Books. He phones Jerry, and he says, "It's time in this field for a book about an invasion of Earth in present time by aliens." And Jerry comes over to my house because we were working at my house because his office was tiny at the time. Jerry says, Bob Gleason says it's time to do a novel about an invasion of Earth by aliens. And I laughed, and then I said, I hope you broke it to him gently that it had been done. Jerry says, yeah, but Robert thinks it hasn't been done well since the War of the Worlds, which excludes some of Heinlein's books, which is too bad. At any rate, we got to talking. I had not quite tumbled just how good a man Robert Gleason was in the science fiction field. I thought he'd come to me as sort of a mundane who dabbled. Not the case. He was dead right every time he predicts a trend, he's right. At this point, he's working for Tor Books. At that time, it was Playboy Books. Jerry and I got together and started talking alien invasion. This is a difficult task, more than you might think. You not only want an alien who can invade the Earth with full force, you want an alien who could do that and lose. Remember what I told you? The alien likely to invade us has been a civilized, tool-using civilization for billions of years. We kind of cheated. We sent them from Alpha Centaurus, which is the closest star, or stars, and we made them a little clumsy. They had inherited their planet from a race that ruined their environment, and therefore they'd been evolved as a baby, as an elephant would evolve under such circumstances. The elephant wound up dwarfed and with a bifurcated trunk. So it's got eight digits. It thinks in terms of eights and regards itself as incomplete unless there are around eight of them.
Well, now, were you talking about footfall?
Yeah, we're still talking about footfall as it began to generate.
Okay.
At this point, we both realized that any alien who is going to invade the Earth is going to use rocks as weapons, unless they've got something even better. So giant meteoroid impacts are going to be a part of this novel. And that's the way we outlined it. We sent in a detailed outline for Footfall, and the response from Bob Gleason was, forget the aliens, do the giant meteoroid impact. Okay, we're nothing if not amenable. We say yes a lot. We look the situation over, and if it's going to be a giant meteoroid impact, I wanted it to be a comet. Asteroids aren't as easy to see. If you can see it coming, it's a lot more dramatic.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a comet. I was right, by the way, in another sense. It's, 40 years later? We've learned a lot about asteroid impacts, meteoroid impacts, comet impacts, makeup of comets and asteroids, location of thousands of them. And one thing we know is that you can't stop a comet. You can stop an asteroid by changing its course, but a comet's course is wobbly. It's as if you had a rock covered with attitude jets. The jets are inside it, and as the comet warms up, you get a blast here, and it's on a slightly different course, and a blast here, and it's on a slightly different course. And the result is, if you try to alter the course of a comet, you're likely to alter it so it hits the Earth. The good news is the danger is about 1%. 99% of the danger is from asteroids, and we have concepts about how to deal with that. Just a diversion. Lucifer's hammer derived from the comet, and we had to do very little research once we had our goal. Given that we both knew everything there was to know about comets, Jerry did some driving. He drove the fire trails around Los Angeles to get our characters out of the area. And it displeases me to tell you that we had to put in some extra roads to make it work.
Well, I think if that thing was coming, I might make a road
if I had to. Yeah, given the right vehicle.
I think that Lucifer's Hammer is interesting, too, because it was really before a lot of the disaster movies and books and things that we got later in the 70s and in the 80s. It was like an Irwin Allen movie in a book, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of, in a way, predated, I guess, The Stand, which is kind of, you know, and then later The Postman and other post-apocalyptic things like that. You guys were kind of...
In fact, the postman, there's a postman in Lucifer's Hammer, Harry the Mailman. And David Brin, who wrote The Postman, swears he didn't borrow it from Lucifer's Hammer. And hell, two writers coming up with an idea simultaneously is a common thing. There's a beanstalk in Arthur Clarke's novel, the Towers of Heaven.
Fountains of Paradise.
Fountains of Paradise, thanks.
Yeah.
And in another guy's, which came out about the same time, with Arthur's statement that the idea had not been stolen. It was that close. So I'm willing to believe David. David tells me from time to time that I keep coming up with ideas just before he gets there.
I was just going to do this ring. So you ended up doing Footfall and Oath of Fealty later.
In Footfall and Lucifer's Hammer. Yeah, well, exactly true.
So you did Lucifer's Hammer, and then you were able to go back and do Footfall, the original idea.
Yeah, we finished Oath of Fealty after Inferno was in place. And yes, Footfall was in the wings. And I can remember Bob Gleason in the back of my car coming back from dinner once saying, "When are you guys going to do Footfall?" And I thought it over and said, "Well, given we're working on other things, and it'll be about 5 years." I hear this choking sound from behind me. He says, "I saw my whole life pass before me." You know, none of us like that kind of delay.
No.
We're all getting older, and it feels like it.
So you decided to take the core concept of Footfall and use it as the core.
Sorry,
technology as the core of Lucifer's Hammer.
Yeah.
So what made you guys decide to go back and do the Footfall story the way you originally intended to? After all,
it's still a good story, after
yeah.
all. Nothing about the story had changed. It was just a matter of nerving ourselves to do two novels about a giant meteorite impact. And all that takes is arrogance.
When you look back on the two, what do you think in terms now? I mean, about how they hold up and everything, and how you react. I mean, do you feel like, do you love one more than the other, for example, or do you feel...
These are the best stories we've done. And each of them was the highest paid advance in the science fiction field at its time. Rapidly overtaken by Arthur Clarke and Robert Heinlein each time. But they had that mark. Footfall, they paid us more money, but we haven't earned out the advance even yet. So I think I like Lucifer's Hammer better.
we'll see in the second half here what the audience wants to ask you. But I'm also curious because I really enjoyed Dream Park. And that struck me also as timely. You're talking about sometimes these books come along when there's like a demand or there's an audience waiting for something like that, like with the alien invasion or the meteor.
It was timely. There were people waiting in the wings who braced us after the book came out and asked if they could borrow our terms. International Fantasy Gaming Society and Dream Park. Mm-hmm. We had to trademark those terms in order to loan them out. And it generated a subculture.
So they actually trademarked, the things in Dream Park are actually trademarked as if they were real...
Yes. Trademarks may have lapsed, but they were in use at the time.
And, it just seems like that was something at that time, like the idea of like almost like Fantasy Island or mixed with live-action role-playing and... I guess you mixed an actual murder mystery into it, too,
yes.
Right, and all that.
Murder mystery within a fantasy, within a science fiction story.
Did that come about because you were playing role-playing games or interested in role-playing games?
I'd been introduced to role-playing games. I played a little. Also computer games, of course, but that isn't live role-playing. And what I was introduced to wasn't live role-playing. It was sitting around a table talking.
Okay, well, let's see if you guys have some questions for Larry, and if we can hear you. Yes, Joker.
You mentioned earlier that Robert Heinlein contributed or sent some suggestions to you and Jerry Cornell when you were working on Loading God's Eye.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that? Can you tell us exactly what he contributed to it?
Quite a lot. Nitpicking stuff. We called an admiral Kurutazov. There's a Russian named Kutuzov, and it's fairly famous to Russians. Robert suggested, as long as it's not that well known in America, why not just use the name Kutuzov, make him a descendant? We did that. He took the concept I had invented, Crazy Eddie. Hmm. Crazy Eddie is a myth among Modis. Crazy Eddie does stupid things at just the wrong time to bring down a civilization. When the cities are clogged with a huge population that can't seem to go anywhere, that's when Crazy Eddie leads the garbage collectors out on strike. Robert looked at Crazy Eddie and said, it's wrong, though. You'll confuse the reader. He'll think that Crazy Eddie is a person, human. Change it to something screwy. And I wrote a detailed, diatribe. I told him he was mistaken, and I told him why he was mistaken. And for years, I thought I'd won the argument. Eventually, I raised the subject, and he said, no, I just gave up. I'm still sure I was right. In that one respect. In every other respect, oh, by the way, I don't know why this is by the way, it's the most important thing Robert said to us on that first pass. And it was the most important thing our agent Lytton Blasingame said to us. Both said the same thing. Chop off the first 100 pages of the book. Hmm. And we did that. And had to reintroduce all the characters. And Jerry had written a battle scene in which you don't know who's playing and you're looking at the wrong side. And I looked at that and thought, this won't work. We're going to have to introduce the book first some other way. So I wrote a prologue. Then Lurton and Heinlein spoke up, and we saw they were right, and we chopped off the first 100 words out of pages. Then we had to reintroduce everything, including what I'd introduced with the prologue. I got it into a scene visiting the Church of Him, who believed that the that God's vision was the cul-de-sac, including including the Murchison's eye for an eye, and a little yellow dwarf that shows a flaw against it, and flares up sometimes. Where was I?
Were there anything else that Heinlein suggested that you felt like you needed that you changed? You were just talking about some specifics.
Let's see. Yeah. And again, he wasn't the only one who said so. We needed to go through that book and chop out a few words each page. We were wordy. Jerry was wordy, and I was wordy at the time, and we both taught ourselves how to chop out unnecessary verbiage. That's what I mean when I say I'm a minimalist. We chopped from well, including removing the opening, both openings. We chopped the book from 250,000 words to 170,000 words, and that's what you saw. And you saw a little more if you saw an article in Galaxy magazine on building the moat in God's eye, which included a lot of my prologue.
Let me ask you this in a moment, since that came up again. We haven't really talked about Oath of Fealty, and that was kind of a different thing from you guys, because you know you were doing a lot of sort of things from space come to Earth, like the meteor, the aliens, or God's Eye, you're going out into space dealing with aliens that I assume if they'd gone crazy would have come in and invaded the Earth or something. But then Oath of Fealty was almost more like ecological, sociological. Where did that come from, and what got y'all thinking about the arcology and the big city and all that? I'm curious. I would have been curious about that.
Jerry had a little list. We were just getting used to collaborating together. We'd done two books, including Inferno and Moat. Jerry had been making a list of expected advances in the future, the near future. Coffee pots that did coffee better than you're used to. Things that actually happened, including that one. We looked through that list, and it included this arcology he'd designed. 2 miles by 2 miles by a fifth of a mile high. I looked that over, and I put in air wells, and I put a diving board at the edge of the roof.
Yeah.
Because that 8 miles of sheer wall is going to attract all the suicides in America and from parts further away. You'll get a lot of Japanese tourists. Jerry designs something huge and cumbersome and works out the details of how to make it work, economic and so forth. Jerry knows a lot of sciences, particularly economics, particularly psychiatry, military, political. And he was Mayor Yorty's political advisor when Mayor Yorty was winning. So he knows a lot about Los Angeles. It was that list that generated Oath of Fealty. And me with my deliberately crazy attempt to make Jerry's assumptions a little less obvious. We've done that ever since. Jerry is the sane one, and I'm the crazy one. And either he's pulling me back, or I'm pulling him forward.
That's cool. Let's see, any more questions? Yes, sir.
Right here.
Meet you next. Go ahead.
With the resurgence of all the new science fiction series you see on television, redoing Star Trek, if you will, Star Wars, it would seem to me that the movies in general would be thirsting after the kind of ideas you generated in your stories. Football had a spaceship powered by nuclear weapons. The Ring World,
first off, it's a buyer's market. There's every writer thinks just as I do. Every novel he's ever written would make a dynamite movie. Aside from that, I signed some contracts with the wrong guy over Ringworld. And the damn problem with my movie career is that mostly people come to me and what they want to make is Ringworld. And I have to tell them, no, there's a guy sitting on it. And I signed the wrong contracts with no time limit. That's the way it was until 26 years after I signed those wrong papers. I got a lawyer. We did some thrashing around. And a new contract emerged that gives Mandel and Mickey something the rights to all four of the books if they can turn them into movies, and puts time limits on them so that they need to accomplish something.
So do we have any hint of...
That's the way it is now. I hear rumors, well, maybe more than rumors, about they've made a deal with the Sci-Fi Channel, and that's all I know. Nobody's contacted me about anything.
That's always what I heard. From the beginning, from the moment the Sci-Fi Channel came on the air, that was one of the properties that I always heard. They said, oh, you know, there's going to be a Ringworld movie. And, and we've all been waiting and waiting. I guess you too.
Yes, yeah. Me too.
How do you think it would translate as a movie? Certainly the visuals would be spectacular, and certainly with today's special effects. But
it's the visuals that would make it. But I would think it would make a dynamite movie. On the other hand, it might be terribly expensive. CGI doesn't cost nothing. Just because you can do something with CGI doesn't mean you can do it for an hour and a half. Ringworld's got an hour and a half with a Pearson's puppeteer in it. I've seen a Pearson's puppeteer costume in action. Kathy Sanders was the artist, and she had to have it open so she could breathe. On stage, she could barely wobble into place. For one night at the Draco Tavern, Kathy's presentation of a dozen of my aliens.
So that's what you get for making a three-legged alien. Is it hard to remember?
That's what I get for being a visual writer.
That's right. This lady over here, yes. The one that was yelling at us.
We're a party.
Okay.
Do you still prefer Madness Has Its Place over The Ethics of Madness? And will you have dinner with us?
I can't have dinner with you. There's a banquet tonight that I'm involved in. As for the Ethics of Madness, it was a good story. I thought at the time that I could come up with a better ending. I'm not so sure I can. It wrapped it up nicely. And as for Madness Had Its Place, I love Madness Had Its Place. I think it's a better story.
You know, one place we need to go is to the fantasy side. We can't leave before we talk about that. You brought a sort of a scientific, mathematical sensibility to the idea of magic and wizardry and stuff like that. Had you wanted from the beginning to do fantasy as well as science fiction, or did something kind of divert you over to that?
I just wanted to write, and I wrote what stories occurred to me. There is some early fantasy. Not very well organized. And then I had this notion of magic as a dwindling resource. I still read fantasy. I noticed that in classical fantasy, the further back into the past you go, the more powerful the magic is. Take that as realistic, and away we go.
So that gave us the magic goes away.
That gave us the magic goes away concept. And I wrote a short story, and then a novella, and then a short novel. And then two more novels. The novels, The Burning City and Burning Tower, written with Jerry Pournelle, also belong to the Magic Goes Away series.
All right, let's see if we got a sermon over here.
And there was a comic book.
Oh, yeah.
Julia Schwartz put together a graphic novel version of The Magic Goes Away from my text. Very nice job.
And that's quite a name and beloved at this convention, too.
Yes. Yes. I noticed. I agree.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
When I write with Jerry Pournelle, the aliens are mine. When I write with Greg Benford, he does a lot of the aliens. But aliens are mine through most of what I've written. Was that the question? Because he was a little faint.
Yeah, he was just saying, because you're known for writing sort of from the perspective of the aliens sometime.
Yeah. Yeah, I took the aliens for Boat and for Footfall. Man, that was tough. I knew I was doing something difficult when I set out a detective story in Footfall, in which you've got to identify one particular alien as the villain.
What about the aliens in The Legacy of Herod? There's like a story involving frogs or something that led us to those. Is that right?
Yeah, that was cute. the aliens are not intelligent in this one, but they are deceptive. In that the colonists have been eating fish-like creatures they call samlin. My pun. The samlin evolve into grendels if you let them live long enough. The grendels in place have been eating their own young, holding down the numbers. You shoot the grendel. You shoot a grendel, you can wind up with a lot of grendels evolving around you. And that tells you as much as you need. You don't need to buy the book.
So you sit right here in the glass.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us something about modern or recent sci-fi that you like and something that you don't like.
I've got a lousy memory for names and titles, so that's a tough one. But what did he call it? David Brin wrote one recently that struck me as an arrogant title. But he lives up to it. What do you call it? Eternity? Existence. Existence, yes. Would you have the nerve to call a book Existence? But he's pretty well laid out the future as per today's physics and other sciences. Yes, it's very expensive to travel in space. Yes, you probably send probes. Never send yourselves. You send minds, and they come as beggars. Read it yourself. It's a great book.
Well, you should just then up him and call your next book this year's Hugo and Nebula Award winner.
Now that's arrogant. I haven't seen a Hugo Award in 25 or 30 years.
But you have more than most people will ever.
I've seen my own, yeah.
Absolutely.
I got five at about the time I needed them. Hugos do tend to go, I think, to the people who need them most.
Do we have any others? Yes, ma'am.
For first off, I should say what my name is. My name is Nessus.
Oh, dear.
But one of the things that has always driven me, somebody asked earlier about writing from the perspective of the aliens, the Draco Tavern stories have always struck me as probably the best example of that, and I love them so much because they're so diverse in the different types of minds you see. So any insight in how you do that and how you get in the mind of something so alien as Slow Life or something like that?
I am really pleased at how well the Draco Tavern stories worked out. They are about 40 years of my career. I came up with an idea for really short stories, and it was the Draco Tavern. It was a bar where humans and aliens meet in Siberia, where the magnetic poles touch down, and that's just for color. It didn't matter where I put it. The idea is to deal with philosophical concepts that are so universal that you can discuss them with things that aren't human and get answers. In particular, the Chirpsithra, who run all the spaceships and who claim to own the galaxy, and it turns out they mean all the red dwarf stars, which is pretty close to owning the galaxy. The Chirpsithra know the answers to most of your philosophical questions. And people around them also know these things. So I've been playing with the Draco Tavern for 40 years and enjoying myself very much. And let's see, the story that really tickled me, it started as part of a presentation in Sweden, North Sweden, up above the Arctic Circle in a research station where Greg Benford got me in. Here are the notions. One, if you can use the energy of the vacuum, if the energy of the vacuum isn't just some kind of mathematical mistake, then using the energy of the vacuum has got to use something up. And I said it was vacuum. You're shrinking the universe when you use the energy of the vacuum. We know the universe is expanding, apparently without limit, and the expansion seems to be increasing. This would work out if species are acquiring intelligence at a reasonable rate. Maybe it does take 13.7 billion years to generate one intelligence. And now there are hundreds, thousands, millions around us developing intelligence and learning this secret. Okay, that's one notion. And one notion is, see if I can remember the other one. Maybe not. There were three. And one of them was, the scientists were claiming they didn't know how galaxies could form unless the universe was a little less uniform than we see them. What if, I said, a life form evolved in the early universe that used the energy of the vacuum? You'd get shrinkage of the vacuum and a concentration of matter until you got the galaxies. And the galaxies, their light would prohibit these original aliens from living any longer. They would die out. I got all of that into one of the Draco Tavern stories, and was really pleased with myself. It didn't win a Hugo. It didn't win anything. I don't know who noticed, but I liked it.
Awesome. We've got about 2 minutes left, and I've got to ask you this for the benefit of myself and everybody else. What's coming up? What are you working on? What should we be looking for?
I had this notion while I was flying here. and I should talk about my two latest novels, both of them collaborations. One with a guy you've not heard much of, Matthew Joseph Harrington, The Goliath Stone. And the other is The Bowl of Heaven with Gregory Benford, of which we have finished the second half. It's a two-volume novel. The second volume will be called Shipstar, and it'll be out in April. Okay? And this notion involves a phrase you've heard all your life, steady as a rock. I finally realized that we'd been spelling it wrong. It's R-O-C. A rock's flight is very steady if you ignore takeoff and landing compared to a flying carpet, which is subject to every gust of wind. And that's as far as I've got.
Larry, thank you so much for your time back. Larry Dillon!
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.